Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, how to turn an oyster restaurant into a church using the power of jazz.
And the leader of a group of business execs on dealing with some of the Valley's biggest challenges.
But first, back in January, the Trump administration revoked an Obama-era memorandum preventing Immigrations and Customs Enforcement, a.k.a. ICE, from conducting enforcement actions in certain areas, such as schools, hospitals, and places of worship. The lifting of those protections left colleges and universities around the country in uncertain territory in terms of how to respond to potential on-campus ICE raids. Molly Bohannon, a reporter with the Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting, took a look at Arizona's 20 higher education institutions with the largest in-person enrollments and found they vary widely in their approaches, and in some cases lack explicit policies for what to do if ICE agents do show up. I spoke with her about her reporting, and we started by talking about the legal gray area created by Trump's revocation of the Obama administration's policy.
A lot of college campuses have what experts consider public and non-public areas or private areas. So a lot of what experts told me was that areas where students or faculty would typically need ID cards to get in are considered non-public. So that's still an area where ICE or any immigration officials need a judicial warrant to be signed to get access to. But public areas, like anywhere you or I could just walk onto campus at Arizona State or University of Arizona, those are public areas. So ICE can now take enforcement actions in those areas without any needed warrant or anything.
But that seems like it could get tricky pretty quickly because, like, I've done stories at ASU, and I have been able to freely walk onto the campus and in some cases freely walk into academic buildings, and I don't have an ASU ID. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it can definitely get sticky, which is kind of why experts are recommending schools have policies or issue guidance and kind of make known to employees, students, student staff, kind of anyone who might sit at a desk and, you know, let people walk in or out to know, like, you know, that can kind of cause some issues.
Yeah. Well, so this gets to the crux of your piece, which is that because of this uncertainty, you reached out to ASU, asked them what their plans were in terms of how to address the situation. What did they tell you?
They did not share a lot of information. So we reached out to the 20 largest higher ed campuses in the state. Arizona State didn't really have a lot to say. They didn't answer our public records request. It's still unanswered almost 2 months later. A spokesperson for them said, you know, we would work with ICE officials the same way we would work with any non-ASU police. You know, there is an online policy about what to do if you see non-ASU law enforcement on campus, but it's just kind of vague and says, you know, call ASU PD and steer clear of the situation, basically. So that's the best guidance I could find from them. But from the students I talked to, some faculty I talked to, they hadn't really heard any communication from ASU about it.
And would it be fair to say that the response you got from U of A, just sticking with the biggest mm-hmm. universities for the moment, was in a similar vein?
Yeah, they more directly pointed towards their non-university law enforcement policy. They said, you know, we have this in place. It does apply to federal immigration officers if they're on campus. But when I asked, you know, have you sent this out to faculty and said this applies, their spokesperson just kind of said, well, it's clear.
Right. And notably, if I remember correctly, they had last updated their policy in 2019.
Yes, that's what they told me.
So from the standpoint of the students and advocacy groups that you spoke to, they would like to see these universities taking a much more proactive approach in terms of communicating who might be vulnerable.
Yeah, definitely. Students I talked to largely, like you said, in advocacy groups, they're feeling anxious. They're feeling worried. A lot of them are from mixed status families, which means maybe they have undocumented parents, but they themselves have legal status. And we haven't seen this in Arizona. I think that's important. Like, there has not been officials on campus at this point, but experts are worried about it. The Trump administration is putting a lot more money towards DHS and towards ICE and immigration So they're worried about this. It's happened in other states. But kind of what I was hearing from students is that there's a sense of anxiety and a sense of fear about even just coming to campus sometimes. They feel like an acknowledgement from the university, even if it is just an acknowledgement and saying, you know, here's our general vague policy, that that could help kind of ease that anxiety and fear.
Right. There are some institutions, however, that have taken that approach, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All of the Maricopa community colleges, they kind of sent out a district-wide guidance policy. So that applies to their 10 schools. They implemented a kind of point of contact system. So there are some people trained on each campus who they said, you know, if an official comes to you and requests access to a classroom, that is a non-public area, call this person. Pima Community College put out, down in Tucson, put out a pretty lengthy FAQ guidance document for students and then one for staff that gave, you know, pretty thorough, like, here are your rights. Here's what to say if you see an official on campus. Here's who to call. Here's who to call if they talk to you. Northern Arizona University and Arizona Western College both kind of put out a little less intensive, but still, you know, more than we've seen at other campuses, saying here's maybe a script to say and here's a reminder of what's public and non-public.
And I should say just quickly before we continue, our KJZZ studios are on the campus of Rio Salado Community College, part of the Maricopa Community Colleges District. It seems like it must be a difficult line to walk for these institutions that have sent out proactive communication because you don't want to create a sense of fear.
I spoke to the faculty senate president or chair of the faculty senate down at the University of Arizona. She was understanding in that she said, hopefully, if they're being silent about this, it means that there's a game plan behind the scenes and maybe they'll make their plan known should this arise.
Hopefully and maybe, doing a lot of work.
Hopefully and maybe. And again, I requested any information internally or externally from the University of Arizona, from all of these schools, even if it was just kind of internal, should we have a policy documents, messages, things like that. They said they had nothing. These universities are in hard positions. They're trying to not draw attention if it's not on them. It is a sense of, you know, you don't want to act like this could be a problem if it's not going to be, but we've seen it across the country. Officials are getting very close to campuses. They're going on campus in residence halls in some places. So, you know, one expert I spoke to made clear, like, this is something that colleges shouldn't wait to address. They should be proactive about because it's going to be easier to solve if it does happen rather than to retroactively say, here's what we should have done.
Right. Right. And of course, we have seen the Trump administration not be shy about directly targeting colleges and universities who they feel have run afoul of their values. Lastly, Molly, you spoke to some individual students who you quoted in your piece. What sense did you get from them about the state of mind that they were in on campus in this moment?
Yeah, students were worried. A lot of them wanted to hear from leadership directly, saying things like, we have your back, like we're here for you. And students seemed to be just a little frustrated at the silence from their leadership, wanting more. Some students at the University of Arizona put together a petition in February asking the school to kind of make their stance known, take a stance against working with ICE unless there's a warrant involved. And, you know, as of now, 7 months later, we still don't have that kind of policy. One student, I thought it was interesting, she talked about, at ASU, talked about how, you know, it's important to have these policies in place to prevent or to have guidance in place to prevent confusion and chaos on campus and to protect the safety of students. But she also made a point to say, like, this protects officers who come on campus. This protects the officials. Like, it just limits the overall harm. And she wanted to see that from the university.
Well, I've been speaking with Molly Bohannon, who is an investigative reporter covering higher education for the Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting. Molly, thank you for this conversation.
Yeah, thank you.
The NCAA is alleging that more than a dozen former men's basketball players at six schools violated rules against sports betting. ASU is included in those universities. The NCAA is not naming the student athletes, but my next guest is reporting who was involved with the Sun Devils. Chris Cartman is publisher of Sun Devil Source for 24/7 Sports. He joins me. And Chris, what exactly is the NCAA alleging happened here?
With ASU specifically, this is not part of the NCAA's release, but this is my own reporting that we've done for Sun Devil Source. Former ASU guard BJ Freeman is going to be accused by the NCAA of making one or more prop bets on games in which he participated. And it's important to say that I don't have reportable information about the specifics of the prop bets. They could have been on him or on other aspects of the team or on other players, and they could have been for ASU to do well. I just don't have any ability to report on those things other than to say that the NCAA is going to accuse BJ Freeman of making one or more prop bets on games in which he participated last season for ASU.
Okay. And as you report, and as I think any Sun Devil fan would know, BJ Freeman is no longer with ASU. He's not a member of the team and left mid-season last year. But while he was there, this was not some bench player. This was a pretty significant piece of their team.
Yeah, he was their leading scorer at the time of his departure. He had arrived at ASU after following the prior season from where he was the Horizon League leading scorer, I believe, in fact. So, and then he had some several problems at ASU. There were some conduct detrimental to the team instances. He was ejected from a game against Arizona for headbutting Caleb Love, the star player for the Wildcats. He also received a flagrant 2 ejection earlier for hitting a Colorado player in the groin area while fighting through a screen. I personally watched that one, and in fairness to Freeman, thought that it might have been unintentional. I don't know. But nevertheless, there were a few things that happened, ultimately culminating with him missing a road trip and then the ASU and Freeman parting ways. He announced later in the spring that he was going to transfer to UCF, but then UCF never announced his addition. But he went through a period of time that was quite chaotic, from being a leading scorer and an extremely valuable, productive player to no longer being on ASU's team, and then now having this allegation made against him.
So the NCAA is saying that it's not looking to penalize the schools that these players were at when these allegations were alleged to have taken place. But I'm wondering what all this means for ASU, even if they're not going to get necessarily punished in this instance. This is obviously not the first time there has been this kind of scandal associated with the men's basketball program at ASU. Like, what does this mean for the program?
Well, this is another reputational hit for Bobby Hurley as head coach going into his 11th season. People may remember that the Sun Devils had a disappointing season last year. So with Hurley now entering the final year of his contract, which is uncommon for college basketball coaches after a very disappointing season in which everybody essentially transferred from the team except for Trevor Best. And ASU will have, I believe, 14 new scholarship players this year, which is a record.
Yeah.
The NCAA expanded scholarships from 13 to 15 for men's basketball this year for the first time. And ASU is only going to have one returning scholarship player and 14 new, which that wasn't even possible before, given the limit of 13 scholarships. So, and then we're also in a new revenue sharing era where the schools are able to directly compensate athletes for the first time this year. And I don't know that ASU basketball got as many resources as a lot of schools, given the nature of Hurley's status as somewhat of a lame duck head coach. So this is quite a tenuous period for ASU basketball. And I think the deck is stacked against Bobby Hurley moving forward. And this just kind of adds to that.
What does it say, do you think, that the schools, the coaches, like nobody involved with the current programs are
the NCAA is not looking to punish any of them. They're really just going after the student athletes involved here. Does that maybe make it harder to get a handle on this?
Well, perhaps. I think it's a, without question, it's a recognition that this is going to be commonplace and already is probably commonplace, given that we're talking about a half dozen schools with players that, that have done this in the last year or the last recent history. So, and that's just the ones that are being alleged formally to have done this. There's probably other players who have given money to other people to bet on things, or, and maybe it hasn't been caught in systems or whatnot. So I think that were the NCAA to try to continue to punish schools in the way that it did in a bygone era, we'd be talking about a never ending series of schools getting caught up in these sort of enforcement actions. And that's, I just don't think that where we're at in college sports today, that that would be a tenable situation. So this is like a lot of other things that have happened in college sports, from NIL players monetizing their name, image, and likeness, and revenue sharing where schools are directly paying players. We've moved a lot more in the direction of players being treated in a lot of respects as professionals. And so just like if maybe an NBA player was betting on his, a prop bet on himself or somebody else on the team, if the team had no knowledge of that, there probably wouldn't be some huge punishment on the team. Maybe there could be a fine or something along those lines, but it wouldn't be akin to what used to be the case in college sports. I think those days are basically gone.
Interesting. All right, we'll have to leave it there. That is Chris Cartman, publisher of Sun Devil Source for 24/7 Sports. Chris, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up for jazz musician Brian Blade, it doesn't matter if he's playing in church or at a dive bar.
The music is still the gift, you know, and mm-hmm. no matter what is around it, I'm still trying to stay in that same atmosphere of praise as I play my drums, as I make music.
We'll hear how music became Blade's traveling sanctuary.
But first, Neil Giuliano has worn a lot of hats over the course of his career. Among other jobs, he was the youngest person ever elected mayor of Tempe. He's also served as the president of GLAAD, an LGBTQ advocacy group. Giuliano is now in his 10th year as president and CEO of Greater Phoenix Leadership, which is made up of business executives from around the valley. He stopped by the studio recently to talk about his decade leading this group, and we started with what stands out to him about the 10 years he spent in the job.
I think one of the things that stands out is how the Valley has continued to evolve and continued to grow, embrace dealing with the challenges, and try to work towards the aspirations for a better tomorrow. I think of the issues we had to work on in education shortly after I arrived. Really, in the first few months that I took the position at Greater Phoenix Leadership, we were meeting with Governor Ducey and his team about Proposition 123 and going to the voters to get more money for K-12 education. That was a really big thing. And then education, of course, has been a significant focus of Greater Phoenix Leadership, going all the way back to right after 9/11. I think the other really significant and fortunate thing that has not stalled, although it had some fits and starts, was infrastructure and making sure that what was Prop 400 in 2004 was renewed by the voters in 2024.
The half-cent sales tax for transportation
to continue to build our infrastructure to allow for the growth that's going to come, for economic prosperity, for places that people live within a few miles of a freeway, all of that, as well as address the urbanization of the region, particularly the connection Phoenix, Tempe into Mesa, with regard to some forms of mass transit, be it a strong bus program, the light rail program, the streetcar program in Tempe, which hopefully in the future will extend further in Tempe and then further east to Mesa, those infrastructure issues were also very, very critical over the last decade.
Let me ask you about the education piece, because obviously Prop 123, we're still kind of talking about that and debating it. The legislature allowed it to expire. They couldn't agree on what to do to refer it back to the ballot. So I wonder, like, what that says to you, that some of these issues that, you know, you remember debating and trying to hash out 10 years ago, we're still kind of in that same spot.
Well, look, this is just my philosophical framework, not necessarily Greater Phoenix leadership's. Yeah. But look, our society is at a different level of dysfunction. There is a new level of disruption in every level of politics and government and society. And that's just sort of what we have to deal with, right? So you have to look for the wins that you can get. And you probably have to form new coalitions among people who are making public policy. And it's more challenging than it used to be, right? Because we find more people in the extremes politically and less people in the middle.
I want to ask you about sort of the business climate in the Valley, and I'm specifically curious because there's a lot of talk before you took over Greater Phoenix leadership about the need for the Valley to sort of diversify its economy, especially after the Great Recession. And a lot of folks were saying too much growth, too much construction, the reliance on those things. Have we done a good enough job of diversifying the economy and making it more recession-proof to the extent that a region can do that?
Well, we have to start with the fact that it has diversified. And we are no longer reliant on construction, on growth, on housing, you know, so the pure growth issues, right? Very intentionally, and give credit to the folks over the last decade who have been very intentional about diversifying our economy. We have to look at the university system, which is putting out more people now with degrees for engineering and other areas that are needed in our state. You know, if you talk to most of the CEOs, and we have about 125 CEOs in Greater Phoenix leadership right now. If you talk to most of them, the consensus will be workforce is our number one issue. Where are our workers of the future going to come from? And worker meaning everyone from entry-level line employees to executive employees. Where are they going to come from? Today, we still don't produce enough of those folks in Arizona. We're still importing people to come to Arizona. Now, that's a good thing too. But that has impacts on your overall economic plans as well, because you have to produce housing that they can live in. You have to have transportation system that they can utilize. You have to have the programs and services and so forth for their young families in your community to attract them to this area. So business attraction and retention then gets heightened to a new level as well. So has it diversified? Absolutely. It needed to diversify. It will continue to diversify. The question now is what will come after what we are now creating? And you sort of think of this in 10-year increments. It's not where we are today, but in another 10 years, in 2035, what will our position be? And what are we doing now to prepare for 2035, 2045?
Well, so when you look 10 years, 20 years out, what do you see, especially maybe as it relates to growth? Because while the Valley is not as reliant on that as it once was, it's still a pretty big component of life in the Valley. And, you know, there's starting to be some questions about, like, how sustainable is this? Like, is there going to be energy? Is there going to be water? Is there going to be a way for people to afford to live here? So I'm curious what you see 10 years out.
Well, the affordability is a separate question from the issue of infrastructure, which would include energy and water. We actually have some of the most solid and secure planning for energy and water of any state in the United States. So I'm confident that our water and energy issues, while there's still some hurdles we have to take on all of those things, of course, we have solid people working on those plans, those long-term plans. The question really then becomes one of, okay, so what's affordable and what's not for the people that we need to attract here? And that does become a question of making sure that we are beginning to localize some of those services. So 10 years from now, here's one issue. What will the work from home status be? We hear that many employers are, quote unquote, calling people back into the office, but they're not calling them back into the office every day for every day.
Like a hybrid kind of thing.
Right. So how do you adjust to a permanent hybrid? How do you adjust to more and more people being able to work from home or from wherever they may be, right, and still be accountable and productive for the whatever institution it is that they're working for? Those are the questions that we need to be thinking about and that we need to further evolve society for into the future. Look, it's nothing like it was when I graduated from college in 1979, and it's nothing like even it was 15 or 20 years ago. And that's just the way it's going to be.
I'm curious in terms of the – you sort of referenced how difficult governing can be right now. And, you know, this is not just an Arizona problem or a Valley problem, but, you know, politics are kind of divisive right now. And I wonder what kind of impact that has on especially your members, like who are focused on trying to get things done. When you look at Congress, you look at the legislature, and yes, of course, they pass bills and do things. But sure. Sort of the general conventional wisdom is these are bodies that don't get a whole lot done.
Well, let me put it this way. It might be okay that not everything is being done, that not everything is being addressed in a period of such high disagreement and high dysfunction where it's tough to find a solution that everybody can agree on. You may have to agree that we're going to have to wait on this one for a while. And things will be more, I would say, more cruise ship turning, incremental.
Taking a longer
over time,
yeah.
Versus speedboat change. Like, oh, we'll do this. No, we didn't know we should do this instead. No, we didn't like that so much. Let's go back over this way. That's not good either.
I guess if it's going to be sort of that cruise ship mode, you just kind of have to hope that the issues that are aboard the cruise ship are not ones that are really pressing that have to be addressed like mm-hmm. yesterday, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. And that's always the challenge, right?
When you look out the next 10 years, what do you see as the biggest challenge that this region is going to have to deal with?
I think housing is one of them. I think the overall issue of just sort of live, work, and play, and where do you want to do that? Obviously, you're going to continue to watch the growth in the Southeast Valley and in the West Valley. The really big things and the really important things are going to take time. And so you just have to go into it with that kind of an approach and bring people around you and pull people along with you as you're moving towards accomplishing those things.
Sure. All right. That is Neil Giuliano, President and CEO of Greater Phoenix Leadership, celebrating 10 years in that role. Neil, thanks for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody.
Well, Mark, the end of summer is almost here.
Yes, indeed. You could probably feel it when you walked outside this morning. I knew I could. Now, of course, it's still going to be, you know, over 100 today, but, you know, it's not not as bad as it has been.
Yes, but you can feel it coming. It wants to get cooler. It just hasn't quite happened yet. But, you know, while most of us may be celebrating the end of the scorching season in Arizona, our next guest has a bit of a counterintuitive take.
Yeah, Roger Naylor is a longtime Arizona travel writer, and as he told our co-host Lauren Gilger, he's a little sad to see summer go.
The problem that I have with the end of summer is that it takes all the daylight with it, especially September. We lose up to an hour of daylight just through the month of September. We lose more daylight. So all of a sudden, it's like we're not just ending summer. We're hurtling towards winter. You know, I like those long, languid days. I like days that where I'm up early and there's the, you know, I watch the sunrise and I'm hiking and I run errands and I get my work done and I at the computer and I do all this stuff. And, you know, after dinner, hey, it's still daylight. It's still, I can still sit down on my porch and enjoy and, you know, I like that. So I miss that. But, you know, I understand in the Valley, summer's like that unwelcome guest that just sits around and sits around. Everybody's gone. You run out of things to talk about. You're dropping hints about how it's time to put up the Halloween decorations. And summer just sits there rattling ice cubes in an empty glass, hoping that you'll make one more pitcher of lemonade and then finally ambles out the door. And by that time, you got to reach for a jacket because, yeah, it's October. It's, you know, it goes fast.
That was my favorite analogy for an Arizona summer I've ever heard. Okay. So tell us, Roger, what have you been doing this summer? You know, obviously probably not hiking in the Valley, but, you know, you always find the places you can go out in Arizona throughout the summer.
I do. I've spent a lot of time on Route 66 working on a project because the Route 66 Centennial is coming up, but I did some other fun. You know, I was kayaking to Emerald Cave that was really fun on the Colorado River there. And I actually was down south doing some hiking in the heat. I'm a desert rat, so yeah. I don't mind that. But I was up on the Navajo Nation quite a bit and up in Page and around there doing some hiking and just having a great time.
Yeah, finding the places to be
when
out.
When you've got those long days, again, you can do some traveling.
Okay, but you actually say that this time of year, this kind of in-between season, we're not quite to fall leaves yet in certain parts of the state. We're still hot here in the valley. This is, you say, your favorite time to travel.
Well, I think it's the best time to travel. I'm a spring summer man, but I honestly think that from middle of September, middle of October, those 4 weeks, the best time to travel Arizona.
Hmm.
Because, and here's my reason, no place is off limits.
Sure.
You know, it's still very mild in the high country in the mountains. It's still very comfortable. Deserts are cooling off. Kids are back in school. Summer crowds are gone, but the snowbirds aren't here yet. So it's quieter. So you can kind of go wherever you want. There's no place that's off limits like in some of the other seasons. It's too hot here. There's still snow there, or this road is closed, and you know, whatever. It's right now the whole state is open, other than sadly the North Rim closed because of fire. You can kind of plan, you know, whatever kind of trip you want. For example, I think Monument Valley right now, best time to go.
Interesting.
Best time to
go. Okay.
Because you don't get the spring winds. The weather is just ideal. Again, all the summer crowds are gone. Take one of the Jeep tours or hiking tours or horseback rides. Learn more about Dene culture and get to experience some of the backcountry, that spectacular place. This is also my favorite time to visit Arizona's West Coast.
Hmm.
Lake Havasu City, Bullhead
Coast.
City.
In quotes there.
Parker right there, because I always like that little extension of summer.
Yeah.
And this is kind of summer light because it's still very nice and warm, but it's not brutal. It's, you know, in the 80s, which is what you want when you're on the water,
yeah,
sitting on the sandy beach and stuff.
All right. Best time to hit the road. Let me ask you about the North Rim right now, since you mentioned it. I mean, this has been a tough time for national parks in general, with massive budget cuts, massive personnel cuts. And then we had this massive and devastating fire on the North Rim that took the lodge, the historic lodge up there. What's the state of the national park system right now from your point of view in Arizona?
Well, they're really struggling. They're operating on shoestrings. They're really kind of patched together. They've cut back hours. Some of them cut back days where the visitor centers are open. They've had to cut back services. You know, the Grand Canyon, fortunately, you know, it's huge and it will continue in operation. I really worry about some of the smaller parks that, mm-hmm, you know, where everybody lives on site, or, you know, they're out in the middle of nowhere, Pipe Spring or Fort Bowie or some of those that are way out there. And I encourage everybody, get out and support them, see them when you can, buy a national park pass. You know, they really need the help. I've talked to several of the park managers, and they all say the same thing. You know, they're all very dedicated and working very hard, but they're having to do it with fewer and fewer people, which impacts visitors' experience. Mm-hmm. You know, the lines will be longer. The bathrooms may not get cleaned as often. People may not be out there on the trail to greet you and stuff. So, you know, show some patience. Be kind. Just to get out and enjoy an experience. You know, because the thought that we might lose some of these really special places is just terrifying to me.
Yeah. What do they mean to you, and what do you think they mean to the country?
This is part of our identity, you know, not only as a nation, but especially in Arizona. You know, we are defined by wide open spaces, and the fact that would be taken away is just monstrous. We are the West. We are the core of the West, and we always have been. We're the Grand Canyon State, you know. But you look around at all these parks that add to that are our, you know, scenic wonders, our cultural treasures, as I wrote in my book, Arizona National Parks and Monuments. We have 34 national park units in this state, and they tell so many layers of our history. They tell those stories. They protect those sites. They preserve our watersheds. They give us this room to move, to go camping, and to experience this. And, you know, on a grand scale, because think about what it means even just locally, wherever you live, you know, how much it means having just a local park, a nearby park where you can get out and breathe in. And Phoenix is blessed to have all these Maricopa County parks, all the Phoenix Preserve Mountains, all these, you know, instantly access. Even though it's a big urban area, you can still get out and have miles and miles of trails or open country. So having that on your doorstep is a wonder, and then to keep it all around us is just that's who we are. We need these quiet places. Wilderness still has value. Dark, starry skies still mean something to us, or they certainly should. And if they don't, then, you know, I don't know where we are as a country or as a people.
All right. Well, I really appreciate that reflection. Roger Naylor, a longtime Arizona travel writer, joining us. Roger, thank you so much, as always.
My pleasure.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. One of my favorite jazz records of all time is called Mood Swing. It's by the Joshua Redman Quartet, and the drummer in that quartet is a guy named Brian Blade. Here he is on one of my favorite songs, Heading Home. Back in high school, driving back and forth to my after-school job, I used to listen to that song on repeat. And then, after college, something amazing happened. I was working as a bellman at a hotel in New York, and one day, Brian Blade checked in. I will never forget the moment that he handed me his cymbal bag, and I checked the luggage tag, and I saw his name. I couldn't believe it was him. And so, when I found out recently that Brian Blade was coming to Phoenix to perform with his band, the Brian Blade Fellowship, I thought, I've got to talk to him. Thankfully, he agreed. And naturally, I began our conversation by telling him about our meeting at the hotel. I told him, I often think about the moment he handed me the cymbals and said, be extra careful with these.
Really? I said that?
Yes.
Sorry.
No. I mean, I could tell, you know, that they were cymbals. And then I asked you your name, you know, so that I could make sure that the bag ticket was associated with your room, and you said, oh, it's Brian Blade. And I said, oh, my God, I love your playing. And you were like, oh, thank you very much. Thank you. You were very kind, very gracious. But the thing that was really eye-opening for me about that moment was I thought to myself, oh, he travels with his own cymbals. Am I making too much of that moment?
No, I don't think so at all. I mean, at the very least, I travel with my cymbals. Usually I have the whole kit and caboodle.
Okay.
So we were traveling light that day, I guess.
Okay. I realized in that moment resonated with the tonality of your playing as much as the rhythm of it. And it made me think to myself, if I ever get to talk to him again, I want to ask him how he thinks about tone. And whether the specificity of those symbols were a part of it.
Well, it's definitely in the hands of the musician. You know, like I could get Elvin Jones symbols and I can put them up, but I'm just not going to sound like Elvin. I'm close. I have his same tools. I have his same sticks. I have his the same drums, and you know, still Elvin is bringing those things to life. I got to spend so much time around some of my dear heroes, Bobby Hutcherson and Wayne Shorter, and the individuality that they brought. Wayne always used to joke, there was something, it might have been a recording of a lesson Charlie Parker was giving someone. But, you know, guys asking about scales and certain approaches and techniques. But then I think Bird said something to the effect of, but can you play what's in your mind? Wayne would always lean in and say it with such a, almost a whisper. And but that's deep. That question is like, okay, are we creative beings? Can we create something? Can you play what's in your mind? That's what we're after.
Well, so in a way, what we're talking about is the connection between body and soul, mind and spirit. And that makes me think about your origins of seeing and playing music at Zion Baptist Church in Shreveport, where, if I'm not mistaken, your father, Brady Blade, was a pastor, and your brother played the drums.
Yes.
What are your memories from being a kid and seeing music in that environment, and how do you think it affected you?
Oh man, it's been immeasurable. It's the bedrock, and it's the foundational experience that I brought to every other situation afterwards. And man, it just hearing the singing you know, praise and worship songs and the way music would open the door, if you will, to everyone. So I was already in this process of like submitting to the music. That's what you want in a band. You want everyone to want the wholeness of a situation and the music to go higher and to touch souls, to touch a heart, to transform what we thought might have been lost or unredeemable to then become something of such value and future hope.
Yeah.
So that was a lot. I'm sorry. That was a lot in there.
Thank you for sharing that. Thank you for sharing that. Can I ask, I love the way you described this about music kind of opening the door to a religious experience for the people in the congregation. Can I ask, was that the experience for you in playing the music? Like, did playing music feel like a doorway to some kind of relationship with God for you?
Oh, definitely. You know, it still is. And that is why I refer to it as this bedrock experience.
Yeah.
It's because after, you know, okay, I'm not playing at Zion on Sunday church, but like, okay, during the week, I'm at, Booker's restaurant or whatever, Centenary Oyster House, some dive bar. It's still like the music is still the gift, you know, and no matter what is around it, I'm still trying to stay in that same atmosphere of praise as I play my drums, as I make music, which I think is kind of the mission.
Thank you for sharing that. That's very beautiful. I mean, so if I'm hearing you right, it's like you experience this connection with something divine within the four walls of the church.
Yes.
And then that awakens in you this idea of I can turn Booker's or I can turn the Oyster House into the house of God.
Exactly. It's like a traveling sanctuary, essentially, from within.
I understand that kind of spiritual anchor that you're describing. What was it about jazz specifically as a style of music, as a way of making this connection that was appealing to you? What do you think you resonated with about jazz as a music?
Oh, man, hard to say other than the freedom that is felt from it. You know, there's this reverence for melody and song, but at the same time, equally as powerful is that vacuum that we can step into that has no script.
Yeah.
And as Wayne would say, let's make a movie, you know, as we would step onto the stage together.
That's what he would say?
Yes. He would say, let's make a movie. Yeah. so, you know, coming from perhaps one of the greatest composers of all time.
Wow.
He wants to just walk out on the wire of the unknown, like not knowing what's across that dark landscape. Like, just put your flashlight on, guys, you know, and lean into each other, trust each other to play what's in our collective minds, if you will.
Boy,
and spirits.
I have to say, Brian, and tell me if I'm mischaracterizing your beliefs at all here, but like it's hard to hear that and not make a connection to faith, the idea that, you know, we walk through this life that is mysterious.
Yes.
Just kind of trusting that there is going to be some guiding unseen hand that takes care of us. And through fellowship, I suppose, with others, we can maintain some sort of connection with that. And sometimes that fellowship takes the form of church. Sometimes that fellowship takes the form of improvising songs together.
Indeed. It's funny. These aren't necessarily thoughts that I speak.
Sure.
What am I doing? What's my mission here? To feel like, okay, souls are being hopefully touched and enriched by something you do.
Mm-hmm.
And that is valuable, especially in, as my dad would say, these last and evil days. during these last and evil days, you know, we need to cling to beauty. I don't know how to describe it, Sam. It's just something profound and mysterious to me.
Well, if I may, Brian, there's something profound and mysterious to me about getting to have this conversation with you after just by happenstance carrying your symbols at the hotel.
Wow.
Brian is performing at the Musical Instrument Museum here in Phoenix on Tuesday, September 16th. Thank you for this conversation.
Man, thank you.
So, Sam, one of the takeaways from that segment is that if I had a musical instrument and needed help carrying it, I could certainly trust you to do so.
Yes, and I wouldn't even ask you for a tip.
That is very kind of you. I would offer you one anyway, though.
I appreciate it. You know what? I would just donate it to the station.
Fair enough. All right. Well, that'll do it for this Tuesday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for being along. Remember, you can sign up for the show's weekly newsletter. It is called Radiohead's. You can sign up at theshow.kjzz.org. For Sam Dingman and Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.